To which group are we devoting our healthcare dollars? Are we favoring one group over another group? Are we blaming any particular group for healthcare cost inflation? That's the topic for this edition of the Bioethics Channel. The Bioethics Channel is a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. Dave Kingsley is with us. He's a research assistant professor at the University of Kansas Medical Center. And we all just went through here at the Center for Practical Bioethics and with yourself as a guest here. And hopefully we treated you well. Most definitely. Where you were presenting some data and some myths and misperceptions and dangers when it comes to healthcare and the elderly. Why don't you give us somewhat of an overview of what you were trying to bring to us today?
Well, I think the myth is that the elderly are a major factor in the inflation in healthcare costs, that aging per se, that we're going to be an aging society, and that per se will increase the cost of healthcare. It will some, but not much, not significantly. A sub idea in that is who is receiving very expensive treatments in the acute care setting. And that's pretty much what I focused on today was a hospital acute care. For instance, the very expensive intensive care cases. There's a myth, misperception, let's say, that the older a patient is, the more likely they are to be on a some sort of life support. We call it intubation and ventilation. That's not the case at all. At age 80, that declines really rapidly in terms of the numbers of people who are in intensive care. Also, as I pointed out, the average cost hospital charge happens to begin to decline at age 80. It starts down. So there's not a linear a relationship between age and cost. So we have sort of some ups and downs in there, and that's the point I'm trying to make, is that at some segment of the, quote, elderly, if we define it at 65 as elderly, sort of a magic age of some sort, yes, we see a bubble in the cost. It peaks at about 75. And at 80 begins to decline rather rapidly. So we have to disaggregate different groups of elderly folks.
Well, one of the questions you asked is, who do you see whenever you see somebody intubated or on some kind of life support? And I would say for most of us, the idea is that we see an elderly person there, but that's not the case at all, and by quite a bit.
That's correct. We call it PRCCS1, which is a procedure code based on ICD-9 codes. We take that code and I pull those folks out of, as I said, the HCUP database, which is 8 million, a sample of 8 million discharges in the United States. About 18% of those, that procedure is under age 5. And when you get to the 80 and on down, you start dropping into maybe 4%, 80 to 84, 3% between 85 and 90. And then after that age, it becomes a very small part of the intensive care in that, or the procedures related to intensive care.
So there are some myths, there are some misconceptions, yeah. But right. There, it still feeds a narrative that's influencing how we look at these issues and how we come to decisions whenever it comes to policy, political or otherwise.
Yes. You know, the plugging granny, unplugging granny, death panels, the narrative is that we're going to have increasing numbers of old are very old people who are going to need life-sustaining treatment, heroic, or that we're taking a lot of heroic measures to maintain life, which is not happening. It happens. Again, I don't want to overgeneralize to say that there aren't hospital situations or acute care situations where a family might persuade a physician to continue treatment when it's not a viable alternative.
So the image out there of the greedy geezer, the silver tsunami in particular, from the data, that's simply not accurate.
That's correct. That is the myth, is that we're going to have all of these retirees hit the healthcare system at one time, and that's going to be a driver in, as we look down the road, in an escalating healthcare cost, which is not the case at all. The retirees that are retiring now, the baby boomers, shall we say, who are 65 in 2011. That's the age at which the 1946 baby boomers, the beginning, begin to retire. But that is a gradual increase from 13% of the population now to 20% by 2035. But that's a period of time. And what I'm saying is it's manageable. That's not a crisis.
Then still, with the way the narrative is evolving, we're starting to get these generational conflicts, I guess you could say. And there are some things around the greatest generation, which we attribute to the World War II generation. And then the baby boomers, which have been termed now the grasshoppers, and where we absorb everything. And so the narrative there is something that influences and drives some of this conflict, right?
That's right. The myth, shall we say, of the selfish baby boomer versus the heroic greatest generation. And, you know, generation is a group of people between certain age groups, but we reify those into baby boomer, which then we generalize to all people born between 46 and 68. There isn't really evidence out there that, or anywhere that I can find, that indicates that there's some characteristic of those folks born between 46 and 68 that would define them as a group of people. That I've mentioned various fallacies, like the fallacy of aggregation or a fallacy of composition, because I saw a few instances of that. Therefore, I can now say that's how I define the group. Same with the greatest generation. We had some great heroes in World War II, so therefore I define all people who were around at that time as the greatest. So that is very counterproductive, in my view.
And there are a wide range of individuals and groups, since we're talking about groups, that are somewhat responsible for this. News media is one. Right. Healthcare experts don't do it any better, apparently, in oversimplifying things, too.
Exactly. I think, true, we're human. It's natural for humans to generalize, because we just can't possibly refine our thinking to take into account all the subsets who are in a group of as large as a generation. We can't do that. We aren't going to look at the greatest generation and look at the racism that was going on or the apartheid that was going on. It was in 1964 and 65 when we started getting civil rights changes, which is a good thing. Well, baby boomers were involved in that. So, you know, we have to somehow, with our limited human minds, think more critically about these generalizations that we make about a group of people.
And you had a term I had not heard before, was the flaw of averages. And, you could do just about anything you want with data, I suppose. But how you use that to form your opinions in this debate is something that's critical, is it not?
Right. The average is another way, I think, of reification, where we say, well, the average age of a person who has neck cancer, head, neck, and throat cancer is 61. And that, what do we see when we hear there's a head, neck, and throat cancer patient? We see a 61-year-old person, when in fact the range of ages is somewhere between, well, actually children all the way to 90 years old. Now, there's the greatest number. If it's a normal distribution, the greatest number is going to be at age 61, but half are above and half are below that, if it's truly an average and it's appropriate. So we take that age, and then we see in our mind what a head, neck, and throat cancer patient looks like.
It comes down to a lot of what we really have an understanding of what is driving healthcare, and a lot of people are making the argument that the aging population is driving that cost. But you shared with us data and information that really it's around technology, right, and the increasing and rapid escalation of technology that's driving costs more than the age of an individual.
Right. In the narrative in the press, I'm always filtering the press, looking at it. The narrative is that we're going to have an aging population. We've got all of these baby boomers, and that's going to increase the cost of health care. And not usually in that narrative is the technology or medical advances as a driver of health care. However, if you look at the medical journals, you look at the CBO report I mentioned, the 2008 CBO report, what the driver really is, the bulk of the inflationary increase is going to be due to medical advances, to technology, medical imaging, genomics, transplantation, implants, those types of advances that we're making. And, you know, we talked about the NICU or the neonatal intensive care, which is a very good thing that we can now help a baby born at 23 weeks at 750 grams where they wouldn't have survived 20 years ago. So that is a major advance, but also very expensive. A good thing, a very good thing, but we have to look at that. We transplant liver, bone marrow transplants, heart transplants. Those are not being those procedures typically are under age 65. For instance, a heart transplant isn't the upper limit on that. Often is 55 or 60, but, you know, we reach that upper limit. And that's why we have a much lower cost for patients 80 plus, because we're not going to do a lot of those procedures because that patient isn't able to withstand the surgery and so forth.
Now, the myths and the misperceptions, these are things that we need to challenge, because we enter into a danger zone if we don't, where we begin to identify, objectify people and punish them for something that isn't really something that they should be held responsible for.
Right. And I think it plays out in public policy. I mean, if we say, well, gee, we're spending all this money on Medicare, which we are, that may not be due to any because we're providing medical care, but because of the way that medical care is being provided. But when we look at the – and we have typical examples. I've been looking at some of the deficit reduction recommendations. Let's take the Bowles-Simpson, which is President Obama's Deficit Reduction Commission. In those recommendations are, let's increase copays and deductibles. The consumer has to – carry a bigger share of the burden. It doesn't say anything about drug prices. It doesn't say anything about regulating medical device manufacturers, like with Senate Bill 2221, which would make them disclose their prices and so forth. So, I mean, you have – so what we're focusing on in deficit reduction, that's true of Ellis Rivlin and Pete Domenici's plans also, is we're going to reduce benefits, which makes the availability of health care more difficult for elderly instead of looking where the costs are in that.
So then, looking at all of this, how should we change the debate? And how will we change the debate if more of this data is comprehended and understood?
Well, I think what we have to do is what we did today. We come together as a group of professionals. We put data on the table, look at how it's analyzed, look at what the medical journals are saying. Of course, we're going to be use critical thinking about that too. And we begin to ask ourselves, me included, am I am I operating, as we know from cognitive psychology, from a subconscious desire to prove a point or to make a point? I think it's, as researchers and professionals, that what we need to do. The media, on the other hand, really probably bought the narrative, you know, that it is the silver tsunami that's coming, or that entitlements are really what is causing the deficit. But as I quoted George Lakoff, is if you buy a narrative, then you don't pay attention to things that are outside the narrative. And that's really our major hope, is for us to begin to come together as professionals in bioethics, in health policy and management, medicine, and we start critically evaluating the narrative.
Dr. David Kingsley is a research assistant professor at the University of Kansas Medical Center. For more information about the center and its programs, go to practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. I'm Laurel LeBou. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.